Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action.
When you get 250,000 people out in front of the White House, you know that you don't have any kind of political consensus behind a policy like the war in Vietnam. So we demolished any claims of consensus behind the war in Vietnam.
It is often said of the 1960s that, quote, if you remember them, you weren't really there. True, much of the social turmoil and paradigm shifting that defined the decade were symptoms of an emerging drug subculture. But not everyone was in it for the free love and LSD. Behind the transparent revolution was a deeper, more sincere movement fomenting social and political change. In the second part of Bruderhof Radio's Roots of Resistance series, we speak with some who experienced the true revolution of the 1960s, the civil rights and anti-war movements. Although these movements were broad-based, far-reaching, and quite complex, the personal stories we found are representative of the larger struggle of the Vietnam era. We spoke first with Tom Cornell, a Catholic worker and historian who lives at the Peter Morin Farm in upstate New York. Tom was a child during World War II, but later worked with several prominent draft resistors from that war. We asked Cornell what was different about resistance in the 1940s and what could be learned from the experience of World War II.
Of course, it was dictated largely by how World War II was perceived and where we were as a society in 1942 to 1945. It was a very, very different feeling, and I can remember. For one thing, we saw our government as really responsive to the needs of the American people. We'd gone through the Depression years. The federal government took an activist role under the leadership of FDR and became, for the first time, really the protector of the common people. We had a feeling of optimism. We had a feeling of cohesion with our government, the society and the government, the state and the society, were one. The rate of conscientious objection was very slight. It was 0.00022 something. It was almost entirely the traditional peace churches, the Anabaptists. The Methodists stood out with a slightly higher rate of conscientious objection, but it still didn't come to even 0.5%. Those who stood aside from the war didn't do it so much because they thought the war was unjust, but simply because it was a war, and their religious convictions were such, and they had taken upon themselves a religious obligation, which is quite legitimate. But there was no effort to obstruct the war effort. People weren't lying in front of troop trains. People weren't attempting to throw their bodies into the machinery. They were abstaining. They were objecting, not so much to what the country was doing, but to the call that they should participate. I think that in the Vietnam War period, something happened that was of monumental significance, a glacial shift in our perception of possibilities and our understanding of the specifically pacifist responsibility. We went from protest to resistance. We went from something personal to something corporate, organized, even institutionalized. In the Vietnam period, we came to the recognition that we can raise an effective political resistance that translates into real policy, effective policy. We are conscious of a spectrum of activities that span from the most conservative and conventional protests, speaking out against, to acts of nonviolent obstruction in various ways, making it more difficult for the machinery to operate by the symbolism that Mario Savio used was throwing our bodies into the gears of the machinery of the state.
By 1965, Tom Cornell had been a draft resister for more than a decade, and it was he who organized one of the earliest protests against the Vietnam War in New York City, outside the home of the Vietnamese representative to the United Nations. But most of the activists who joined him in the 1960s were from the next generation. Raised in the cultural complacency of the 1950s, Tom Big Warrior joined the movement as a high school student and remembers how his generation, the baby boomers, viewed the need for change.
We began kind of with a paternalistic concern for, you know, poverty. You know, I mean, that was the official line at the time. It was the war on poverty and the new frontier, you know. And we were very idealistic in believing that the system itself, the capitalist system, could provide those kind of changes and reforms, when in reality the system depended upon the inequality of, you know, rights and services and stuff in society. That was the real foundation of it. And that to make those kind of changes required really changes in the foundation of American society. Culturally, black music had broken the color line, you know, a few years earlier with performers like Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley and others. But the fact that we were moving away from a totally isolated white world to a world that was much more cosmopolitan, in which, looking back at the white world, you look back at it with a different eye, you know? It wasn't all that it was cracked up to be. You know, the values were pretty shallow. What it really offered was just material comforts, but not, you know, strong spiritual values or community interaction that, you know, we were finding, you know, on our own.
Along with the sense of alienation from white bread culture came greater solidarity with the civil rights struggle of African Americans. In the end, both the civil rights and anti-war movements would depend heavily on collaboration between blacks and whites. But according to Tom Cornell, the real formation of this coalition took place well before the 60s, in the aftermath of World War II, when young pacifists like himself could form their own opinions under the guidance of an older generation of resistors.
I tried to get into my head their understanding of things. And as I did, I saw that their political analysis, their social analysis, was more pertinent than the one that I had brought with me. And so I learned from them, and I became kind of socialized into the nonviolent movement by the Catholic Worker and War Resisters League fellows of the World War II period, the World War II resistance. And at the same time, I was involved in the race movement. This always went hand in hand with me. And if you know anything about the experience of the guys in World War II prisons, they had a lot of time to study together. The federal government didn't know what it was doing, but it was giving the nonviolent movement an enormous shot in the arm by gathering these guys from all over the country and putting them together in prisons and CPS camps. Otherwise, they would be scattered so thin that they wouldn't know each other. They wouldn't be able to have the kind of interrelationships that would bring about their maturity as nonviolent activists. But they recognized that race is the principal social question in the United States. It has been all along. It continues to be the fault line of our society. So that's why the first Freedom Ride was in 1947, not 1960, the one that people remember. 1947, and everybody on that bus that went down south to test whether a black could sit next to a white in interstate travel, every one of those guys was a prison veteran.
And while these older activists gave credibility to the movement, it was perhaps the sheer force of numbers that made the protest movement most effective. By 1967, an astonishing percentage of Americans were turning out to express their discontent with the status quo. Some were conscientious objectors, Others were just scared of being drafted. And then there were the civil rights groups who came in support of both causes. Tom Big Warrior recalls,
I guess things kind of pretty much came together as far as the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in the spring of 67. There was a huge demonstration in New York City, which was at that time the largest, I guess the first really mass anti-war demonstration. And I was, like I said, 16 at that time and in high school, and a carload of kids and myself went into New York to take part, and we're just totally flabbergasted that there were that many people. And it was largely the addition of Martin Luther King and really thousands of black civil rights workers to the demonstration that made it as huge as it was. And I think it sent a real shock of paranoia to LBJ and the administration at that time to see these two movements coming together. Aside from just the manpower that it brought together, politically it took the civil rights movement to a higher level in that it went beyond a humanistic concern for the inequality in American society to an understanding of slavery and the continuing oppression of their descendants, the African slaves, along with the dispossession and genocide of the American Indians as being the root of imperialism, the foundation of it, and that Vietnam was the continuation of it. And I think with that understanding really made possible the Panther movement and a struggle to really make fundamental and revolutionary changes in American society and in the world.
You're listening to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse and progressive thought and action. If you have questions or comments about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. To the extent that war in Vietnam was politically, socially, and morally wrong, it seemed to many who opposed it to demand a higher level of resistance. This became known as non-cooperation and usually took the form of refusal to register for the draft. But for some who had already registered, the public incineration of draft cards became a popular way of signifying one's non-cooperation with Selective Service. Tom Cornell first burned his draft card in 1960 following a protest of a nuclear submarine under construction at the Naval Yard in Groton, Connecticut. During the protests, Tom temporarily lost control of the rowboat carrying him and several other activists and suddenly found himself face to face with the submarine itself. He touched its hull and was immediately struck by the machine's singular capacity for the destruction of human life.
We rowed back to the shore and I joined a friend of mine. We said, let's go for a beer at the Goldenrod. So we went to the Goldenrod Saloon on Bank Street in New London, and we ordered a glass of beer each. And the man behind the bar said, son, are you 21 years old? And I said, no, sir, I'm 26 years old. And he says, can I have your draft card? So I pulled out my 1-0 draft card. Now, I was very glad to have this 1-0 draft card. I worked hard for it. It meant that I was a signed, sealed, and delivered conscientious objector. So I was very happy to have that 1-0 card. On the other hand, the experience that I had just gone through, touching that machine, it changed something in me. And I said, it's time now to take another step. And I think I'm going to resign from Selective Service altogether. I'm going to make as if I had never registered. I'm not going to cooperate with these people again. A fella handed me back the draft card, and I said, I don't want it. So I burned it. in an ashtray there. I had several other cards, by the way. I had 2S, a student deferment from high school, 1S from college, or vice versa, I don't remember. I had a 1AO, I had a 1O, I had another 1A from having been out of school. I don't know how many cards I had. I think perhaps 10. And I burned them at various points along the way when there was a demonstration and it seemed as if it was going to add some kind of drama and make the point that there is the alternative of non-cooperation as well as the alternative of conscientious objection, and that the alternative of non-cooperation has a pointedness that's very valuable and energizing, but it's not for everybody because the probability is very high that you're going to pay a price.
For Tom Cornell, that price was 6 months in federal prison. Others served even longer sentences. But in general, these personal displays of non-cooperation did more to inspire the movement than actually shift public opinion. In this, the mass actions that became the trademark of the 60s were by far the most effective. After all, it was the sight of hundreds of men and women being beaten by police on the lawn outside the Pentagon that finally convinced Daniel Ellsberg to leak the Pentagon Papers. And that, in retrospect, may have been the critical blow against the war effort. Tom Cornell describes one of these marches.
We called our demonstration the Assembly of Unrepresented Peoples, and we walked from the Washington Monument to the Capitol, which was in session, with the announced intention of entering the chambers and convening a Congress of the Unrepresented. Well, of course, that was hyperbole and romance. But there were people in the Congress, in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, who thought this was the beginning of the French Revolution or something. They really went ape. As we marched on the Mall, the police would stop us at various points, saying, "This far and no more. If you proceed any further, we're going to charge you with trespass or disorderly conduct." But we kept on marching slowly, without any kind of sense of antagonism toward the police or anyone else. Some Nazi decided he was going to throw a bucket of red paint at us. And what a favor he did, because this added quite a bit of drama and gave the photographers something to photograph. It looked like blood, of course. It was thick oil paint. The Life magazine photographer was successful in getting Life to publish the photograph. It was, I think, the July 24th issue, 1965, Life magazine. It had a full-page color photograph of this very dramatic moment. The marchers attempting to seize the Capitol, all with red paint splattered upon them looking like blood.
In the same issue of Life magazine was a picture of a nameless young man burning his draft card. Cornell says these pictures had perhaps more effect on government policy than the acts themselves.
There's no big reaction to these events. It was late August when the magazine came out, but I guess when the senators went to the Senate haircut parlor, barbershop, and sat there reading Life magazine, which is, I think, where they got most of their intellectual nourishment, when they went to get their haircut at the Senate barbershop, some of them became infuriated at these photographs. And it was one of the real segs from the Deep South who got up, I forget who it was, who proposed to the Senate that they make it a federal offense, a felony, to burn a draft card. And that legislation just breezed through the House and the Senate with no significant debate. And it occurred to me immediately, hey man, this is nothing other than an attempt by the government to intimidate young people and to stifle dissent. And that's not what our legislative process is for. That's not the Constitution. This is a perversion of law. This is not what the law is there for. It's not what the Congress is there for. The Congress is not there to find ways of circumventing the Constitution or nullifying the Constitution. Says the only responsible thing to do at this point is to get some draft cards and burn them. So I wrote to that effect in the September issue of the Catholic Worker, and then it occurred to me after about 2 weeks later, hey, I can't do that. I can't tell young guys to burn draft cards without doing it myself. So I had to write to my local draft board and say, dear ladies and gentlemen of local board 16, I am not in possession of a registration or a classification certificate. I had two, you see. I burned them years ago. Would you send me replacements? And they did.
We asked Cornell's opinion of the apparent success of the anti-war movement in the 1960s. Did the government even care that people were protesting?
It knocked any kind of democratic legitimacy claims from out from under the administration. You can't. You know, we thought this was really a democratic thing to do. A war shouldn't be fought if the people are against it. I mean, it seems that should be a clear enough democratic principle. And when you have large elements of all these sectors of the population coming out, everybody who comes out represents how many people who don't come out but feel the same way. I don't know the mathematics, but when you get a quarter of a million people out in front of the White House, you know that you don't have any kind of political consensus behind a policy like the war in Vietnam. So we demolished any claims of consensus behind the war in Vietnam. Then what had to be done, the rest of it, to deny the government any legitimacy at all, was what Daniel Ellsberg achieved in doing when he exposed the Pentagon Papers. It lasted far too long. We didn't stop the war. I wish we could claim to have stopped the war. I think we can claim legitimately to say that we restrained the administration. We have pretty good evidence that the use of nuclear weapons was considered at least three times. But given the level of dissent, the administration was convinced that it would bring such an outpouring of antagonism toward it that it wasn't worth it.
But what became of the protesters themselves? Certainly, some remained active, but the great majority burned out, moved on, or found some other way of slipping back to normal life. For them, the 60s was only a trip, something they had done growing up. A few, however, found new ways of living out their convictions that lasted beyond the rhetoric and beyond the 60s themselves. Faced with a crumbling society and a government unresponsive to their demands for a democratic process, they searched for fulfillment in various forms of service and community building. Kevin Bruce's story is in a way typical of these lifetime activists.
I joined the Peace Corps, and I was in the Peace Corps while my brother was in Vietnam. We spent 2 years, my wife and I, we got married and left the same day for Micronesia in the South Pacific, and spent 2 years on a tiny island. And our whole perspective had to change, because here were 500 people living in a primitive existence on a Pacific atoll with basically coconuts, fish, taro, and breadfruit for their sustenance. They lived as kind of extended family. It was very communal. And Barbara and I had grown up in a very middle class, or you could say upper middle class situation, where we only thought about ourselves. And this was a radical wake-up call for us, and we felt like many young people that in the Peace Corps we could do an alternative service that would benefit the people we were helping there, and it would also benefit us by giving us insight outside our routine pattern of life that we had lived up to then. In the Pacific, we heard by Armed Forces Radio the murder of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, the riots at the Chicago Democratic Convention, and we realized that the protest movement had splintered into various degrees of activism. And although we wanted a peaceful world, we looked at the movements that we saw out there, and we did not find one that we felt was going to capture the hearts of all the people. We realized that we were a long way from a peaceful future, and it began to sink in that we had to use deeds rather than words. What we had accomplished on our little island was great for those people, and it made a statement to our families back home. And so we kind of built on that. We got a job teaching in the inner city in New York and spent 3 years in a junior high school where we had a very concentrated population of minority kids basically being kept off the streets in a kind of caretaking role. Because more than half the parents were on welfare, our principal could write a letter every year and get me an annual deferment from the draft, and we did that till I was 26. And at that point, we had to decide, are we going to opt into the system? Am I going to become a teacher and live here for the rest of my life? Is this where I want to raise children? Is this what I believe in? Or are we going to strike out on our own and find something radically new? So, in short, we did. We left for Europe and spent 8 years then in Spain.
And so the 60s ended in fragmentation, offering fulfillment for the daring, depression for the weak, and a clear road ahead for the powers that be. The outlook today offers little room for optimism. De facto racial segregation is the norm, and the military-industrial complex still exerts far too much influence on our government. But if the goal is real change from the bottom up, then it is ultimately the people that will have to change, not our government.
We are interested in changing society. The whole point of the Catholic worker movement is to change society, to confront society on a radical basis. At the Worker, we were trying to figure out how we could do things that would accelerate the processes of change. We didn't want to burn our draft cards just to make a spectacle, but we wanted to accelerate the development of a mass movement against the war. We had to build a mass action. We didn't expect masses of people to go out and burn their draft cards. No. But we had to energize people to get out on the streets to show the government and the world that the conscience of the people had changed, that they were saying no more of this. And we succeeded. But we did it very consciously using these Gandhian techniques.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio, a look back at the 1960s. Join us in 2 weeks as we wrap up our examination of resistance and protest with a look at today's activist movements and the fight against global corporatism, economic inequality, and racism. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman, with writing and additional research by Ben Wright. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us at 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 800-778-8461. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for.